dish with us on the line from Redding, California, or thereabouts. And Mark is quite an interesting fellow, as you know. We've had him on the air before, and we'll have him on the air again. But Mark, back in the 90s, went to Aztec, and he'll tell us in this interview why. And he visited the crash scene. It was all because of a book that he read called UFO Crash at Aztec. And it was written by the late, great Wendell Stevens, along with William Steinman. And that book, I believe, is still available, at Amazon at least. And it was quite an inspiring book. As you'll hear, when Mark talks to us, he checked everything out. And Wendell and William had it pretty much down right as far as the facts about the crash scene and things like that. Anyway, Mark, thanks for joining us, and I look forward to hearing this story. You were quite taken with this book, I take it.
Well, the book was published by published jointly by Wendell Stevens and William S. Steinman. In fact, I've got the ISBN number here for anybody who's trying to find a copy of this. It's 0-934-269-05-X. And anyway, I was kind of intrigued by, you know, these stories of crash retrievals like the one that occurred in Roswell. And apparently this particular crash happened a little less than a year after the Roswell crash. In fact, sort of the funny coincidence in all of this is that it happened on my birthday, March 25th, about 5 years before I was born, so in 1948.
And so what conclusion do we draw, that you were part of that Aztec crash and E.T. among us?
Yeah, I know we were joking earlier about how I might have been a reincarnated alien or something, but anyway, so I picked up a copy of the book, and it turned out that a year or two after that, I was living in Southern California at the time. I had picked up a ZF transaxle out of a 74 Pantera that I needed to have rebuilt. And I had a little Fiero that I was contemplating turning into some kind of a kit car project, you know, make it look like a Ferrari or something. So I decided that I would take out the passenger seat in this Fiero, put a piece of plywood on the floor of the passenger side, and basically strap down this giant transaxle on the floor of the Fiero and drive cross country up to a spot in Illinois where the ZF company had a transaxle repair center. Apparently, some of the drivetrain components for the Corvette that was, I think it was a C5 Corvette that had kind of a split drivetrain where the transmission was in the back, also was using some ZF components. So they set up a repair installation here in the United States. It's called ZF of North America, I believe. Anyway, so I was going to drive cross-country to drop off this transmission because it seemed like it'd be cheaper and more reliable than sending something this big and heavy through the mail or with UPS. And I figured as long as I was going to do that, I would pass down through New Mexico where I had some relatives living in the area of Clovis and Albuquerque. And this particular site was right along the way. I also went up and visited the area around the Archuleta Mesa in Dulce, New Mexico.
Oh, really? You'll have to tell me about that, too.
Yeah, it was a very strange experience. But anyway, in the book by Wendell Stevens and Steinman, on pages 32 and 33, there was actually a map in there showing where the crash location occurred. And it's probably about two-thirds of the way up a canyon called Hart Canyon. And I actually... you know, by looking at the topography and the map, plus the map that I had, and the fact that there's an awful lot of petroleum industry drilling operations in this area, so it wasn't too hard to have or to run across someone who could say, oh, yeah, you go down this way, and you make a right, and you follow it out, and you'll... So and it just so happens that it's sort of a tributary canyon off of a much larger canyon for, let's see, it looks like the Animas River, which kind of comes in from the north into the town of Aztec itself. And so the crash location is actually a little bit north and to the east of the city or the town of Aztec. And the book, the cover of the book actually has a photograph on the front of it that shows kind of a low cliff, rock escarpment that's just immediately to the east of where the crash occurred. And one of the landmarks that's described in the map of the actual crash site that's on the next page, page 34, it actually shows a large concrete block. Now, there's been some debate about what this concrete block was for, whether it was used as the foundation for some kind of a crane that they literally installed overnight to give them a support for lifting pieces of this craft onto a number of flatbed trailers. The biggest problem they had, according to the book, was this 100-foot diameter saucer, which had kind of a spherical crew compartment buried right at the center of it, and the crew compartment was about 18 feet in diameter, more of it sort of sticking out above the center line of the craft than below. It was essentially a seamless looking vehicle, and the only thing that the only access point that they had were a number of mirrored glass panels on the upper part of the crew compartment, one of which appeared to have been broken. And there's no specifics about what may have caused that, whether it was a meteorite impact or whether this thing had been shot at, but they could not figure out how to get into this thing to break it down and basically transport it across country. And eventually what they did was they found this opening in one of these windows. They took a long stick and they started poking at some of the buttons that they saw in the crew compartment, and one of them actually sort of caused a kind of a hatchway to drop down from the underside of the craft. And so that's how they were eventually able to get access to this vehicle. And William Steinman apparently tracked down and interviewed a number of people who'd been involved in photographing the crash for the military, who were able to describe, you know, what happened, how they logistically supported the removal of the craft from the site. It turns out that Hart Canyon is pretty much, I don't know, probably about 100 to 200 foot wide dry riverbed that runs sort of in a west-southwest to east-northeast sort of a direction. And then it makes an abrupt turn to the north right at this rock escarpment that I was describing earlier. So the one outstanding landmark on this particular site is this large cement block that seems to have been a part of this removal operation. And so I actually found that. And in fact, I'm looking at the site on Google Earth right now. And for your listeners, I can actually give them the coordinates of this cement block. It's 36 degrees, 51 minutes, 58 seconds, and 0.78 inches north by 108 degrees, 1 minute, 4 seconds, and 0.73 inches west at an elevation of just under 6,000 feet above sea
level. Now, you actually saw this block yourself in person.
Yes, I did. That cement block was still there in about 91 or 92 when I passed through the area. Of course, it's all sort of, you know, dilapidated now, covered with moss and graffiti and things like that. I don't think anybody there really appreciates or understands what this thing was.
Mark, can you give our listeners a little bit of your impression of the place?
Looked around the site. In the book, the person who eventually found the site, I believe it was probably William Steinman himself, said that there were areas of the ground that appeared to have been scorched. Rocks that had discoloration on them, and in my, you know, I've always been kind of a rock hound. You know, I grew up in parts of Arizona and did a lot of fossil hunting and things, and so I spent a lot of time trying to recognize different kinds of geology, different kinds of rocks, and the things that I saw that might have been perceived as scorched rocks really looked to me as though they were rocks that had just experienced a lot of weathering, probably had a high iron content in them, and so the iron content, you know, sort of it tends to corrode and rust and turn sort of a brownish color. So it does look scorched, although I think it's really just a patina from the iron oxide that's sort of leaching out of the rock itself, rather than some kind of a temperature problem or some exposure to you know, higher temperature. And the way that I tried to sort this out in terms of validating whether or not that really was the case was I went several hundred yards in every other direction to see whether there were also rocks in those areas that exhibited these same kind of features, and that's exactly what I found. So it was fairly uniform throughout the area. There were a couple of, it looked like pieces of old rusty rebar with some steel plates welded to the end of them. And there were a lot more of these found at the time that William Steinman located the crash site, and some of them appeared to have been, according to his testimony, appeared to have been welded together into what would amount to sort of a, I guess it would be like a three-sided pyramid sort of thing, where they took the, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, probably eight rods, welded them into like a little triangular shaped pyramid with pads in different areas to support the craft or hold it up off the ground so they could get underneath it and through this doorway, because it was right on the ground. It's kind of crashed, made an impact on one side of Hart Canyon, and then sort of bounced back into the air and then came to rest on the other side, the north side of Hart Canyon, coming in from, I think it was the southeast, if I'm not mistaken. But that, you know, they the soils in this area are extremely sandy. The area that's just to the north of Hart Canyon where this thing came to rest really isn't much more solid in terms of footing than the actual floor of the this dry riverbed called Hart Canyon itself. So it was kind of interesting to be there. I, you know, of course, didn't expect to find little pieces of foil with alien writing on them or anything like that. But it did appear as though something had happened there at one time, and it's really kind of hard to tell based on what I found that it had anything to do with the impact of, you know, a craft from some other solar system.
But so potentially what you saw up there years later were items, small little items that might have been used in the retrieval of the craft.
Yes. Yeah, and that was the assertion that was made in the book. I mean, you know, it seems pretty odd that you would be out in the middle of the desert, as it were, and find this this large cement block. I would have estimated that it was, it was hard to tell how deep it went down below the soil, but it was at least 3 feet above the ground when I was there. And I would say it was at least, maybe 15 feet long, about 9 feet wide. So it was a pretty substantial mass of concrete. And it looked as though it had been poured into some kind of a quickly formed, form that was, sort of a mold that was constructed out of either plywood or wooden planks, because you could see the grain of wood in some of the areas of the concrete itself.
What about those that say, well, that's all oil field debris, because oil field operations go on there?
You know, there are a number of other oil field operations in that area, as I was saying before, but generally if you're thinking of something like this as being a well that's been capped off, you're going to have some kind of a fixture on the top of it, or maybe even a piece of steel pipe that goes down through the middle of it that's been cut off, and then a cap has been welded to the top of it, and there was nothing like that at all. In fact, there wasn't even anything at the site designating that this was part of or property of any kind of an oil company or an oil company operation. It was just a big cement block, just 100 feet or so north of this dry riverbed.
Mark, I know you're a very practical, technical guy, but while you're up there, did you feel some vibes, some ambience of what might have happened?
Well, I try to be sensitive to those kinds of things. I did have one of the things that they tell you about the desert as an environment is that it's a really sensitive kind of place. There are places out near Fort Ord in the high desert north of Los Angeles where even now, 60 years later, you can still see the trails left by the tanks that Patton and his people, his troops, left when they were doing training exercises for some of the invasions that occurred during the Second World War. You can still see the tracks left by those tanks. And so, when you look at the environment, one of the things that I tried to do was to see if there were any kinds of marks or things that had sort of filled in over time where the vegetation hadn't really grown back at the same rate as some of the other surrounding areas of mm-hmm. sagebrush and things around there. But it's really hard to tell. I mean, I would imagine that if I was part of a recovery team and there was going to be any question about whether the site had significance down the road, one of the things that I would really go out of the way to do would be to remove as much evidence of any kind of logistical operation as possible. Now, even now when I look at this site on Google Earth, you can see evidence of heavy equipment having moved through the area. Now, to my eye, it looks like something that's happened a little bit more recently. There do seem to be some residual marks that show some kind of activity happened there many years ago. You can see areas where the sort of random distribution of the sagebrush seems to be interrupted with a clear margin in two areas of this particular site that almost suggests some kind of heavy equipment or a bulldozer was brought in at some point and something had been moved around. You generally don't expect to see that out in a remote area where there's not a lot of activity going on. But that's not to say that it couldn't have been something that happened, in the 50 years since then because of all the oil drilling activity that's going on in the area, whether it's a survey crew in a Jeep or, somebody bringing some pipe in to, connect a newly drilled oil derrick to a supply system. So it's really hard to tell. There's all kinds of piping going through the entire canyon. So it's a very active site in terms of the oil industry. It's kind of a toss-up in terms of whether anything that you can see there geographically is the result of some kind of logistics operation for moving the craft. One of the things they did mention in the book that I thought was kind of interesting was that the craft was apparently assembled in pie-shaped sections, but the joining of the different metal components was so seamless, so perfect. It was almost as though the pieces had been all brought together and then the entire craft had been put on a giant lathe and everything had been smoothed out so one piece to the next was so perfectly smooth you literally couldn't see the seams between the different parts of the craft. And it wasn't until after they gained access to the craft that they actually found a number of interlocking key-like mechanisms that would allow them to disengage one segment from the next. And the whole thing came apart like a big puzzle. And they were able to break it down, stack the pieces, put them under a big tarp on a flatbed truck, one or more flatbed trucks, and haul them off. There's some indication that after the Roswell crash, the military had established something called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, or IPU.
Tell me about that.
Well, they claim that this was a scientific branch of the military. It was based out of Camp Hale in Colorado. Now, the other thing that they talk about is the fact that some of these things were transported to a base up in Colorado, and that it was then flown from there to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was in or near Dayton, Ohio. But
and well, Mark, you mentioned Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and you're no stranger to that area. You actually have a painting of Billy Mitchell, or did, on display at Wright-Patterson.
Well, that's right. There is a painting. I don't know if the building itself is open to the general public, but it was the Billy Mitchell or General Billy Mitchell Memorial Logistics Center for B-1 and B-2 systems in the Air Force. It's the building that where all of the data processing and logistical direction for supplying the B-1 bomber and the B-2 bomber systems throughout the Air Force. It's where all the coordination for that activity occurs, and they've got a very large lobby. It's probably 3.5 stories high inside, and there was a request that came to me from a interior design firm back in that area that asked me to do a vertical format 16-by-20-foot mural for that building.
Yeah, Mark, we knew about that. In fact, we know quite a lot about you. Our researchers, our producers have found out that you're a pretty innovative fellow. So this story about taking the transactyls to Illinois in this little car is not unusual for you.
Well, I've done some crazy things. You should have seen the problem with creating a painting of that size in a vertical format in a place like Reading is that it can be pretty expensive to rent an industrial shop space with a ceiling that's over 20 feet high, especially if you're going to create the painting in the same kind of perspective that one would expect to see it in the lobby of this building. And I simply could not find any site in Reading that had over a 20-foot ceiling where I could spend several months doing a painting. And coincidentally, I had a Cadillac Northstar engine, which had also been part of this proposed kit car project. The sad thing about it was that after I got the transmission rebuilt, I was coming into town, moving my Fiero, and a lady pulled out of a side street without looking, and I T-boned her car and totaled my Fiero. So
oh, man, suddenly, after all that trouble.
I know. It was my pride and joy. I just loved that little car. It totaled the Fiero, and so I had
did to it hurt you
for the transmission or the Northstar engine. That was kind of be my yeah. engine transmission combination. And when I put an ad in the paper to sell the Northstar, the Northstar engine, turned out I was contacted by a fellow who was interested in buying the engine. The funny thing was, he called me from Hawaii, and I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to get this engine to Hawaii? And he said, oh, no, I live near Reading. He says, I'm on vacation, and, I want to see the engine when I get back. So please don't sell it to anybody else. And apparently his wife had a Cadillac. The engine had burned up. And so sold him the engine, and as I'm taking it over to his place, he's got this giant garage with 16.5-foot ceilings. And I said, say, Gary, do you think that maybe... So we made a deal, and he let me spend about the next 8 months assembling this giant scaffold to actually do the painting. And it wound up, if you've ever seen those reversible chalkboards that they have in college, where it has sort of a rolling A-frame with two pivot points at each end, and you can flip the chalkboard over to do equations and then, flip it over. Imagine something like that, where the pivot point is about 9 feet off the ground, and you're using 4x6 lumber and giant casters, and I got a 21-foot long piece of 3-inch steel pipe, and I created a series of trusses on the back of this thing with struts and outriggers that went out to the edge of this 16-by-20-foot stretcher board that was faced with masonite to give me a firm backing, and then I had a custom canvas stitched together by a company that makes boat covers, and stretched the thing over this backing, stapled all, it must have used 3,000 staples around the edges, and put a gesso primer on it and started painting after they'd approved the composition. And the funny thing about it was they wanted the face of Billy Mitchell to be fairly large in this format. His face wound up being something like 6 feet high. And so if you imagine having a picture of your face blown up and every little pore and acne scar from when you were a teenager. You know. And the thing was that Billy Mitchell had a lot of battle scars from the First World War and a lot of pock marks from when he was a teenager. Apparently he had a lot of problems with his skin. And so, you know, I had to be sort of delicate about how I illustrated this gentleman because, you know, after all, I mean, who wants to see that kind of...
3 foot acne. We don't want to see that. Mark, this is an incredible thing you did. In fact, almost everything you've done is pretty incredible. You actually rolled this thing up and drove it across country in a snowstorm.
Now, I had several people that agreed to help me dismantle this thing. I wanted to maintain the 2x2 structure that made up the lion's share of the stretcher framework that this thing would be reassembled on once I got it to Wright-Patterson. And, you know, I couldn't find any truck that was large enough to transport it intact. It would not even fit into a normal semi-truck, and it would have been exorbitantly expensive. I mean, just astronomically expensive to transport all the way to Dayton, Ohio from, you know, Redding, California. So I had to find some kind of innovative way to transport this thing, and so I had an 89 Maxima, and I found that when these cars were shipped over from Japan, they put these brackets on the lower part of the frame, the chassis, that they would use to tie these things down on these big transport ships so they wouldn't move around if the ship encountered rough seas. And so I used those pickup points on the frame to have a steel framework. It was using 3/8 inch thick, 4 inch wide steel plate that I had cut to various dimensions. Basically had a series of bolts that, and grade 10 bolts and grade 12 bolts that extended down from the frame out beyond the bumper and then formed an A-frame that had cross supports on it, all screwed together with these grade 10 bolts. And then it had two pieces of steel that were bent into the shape of like half of an octagon, like the lower half of a stop sign shape. And that was the cradle for a 22-foot long piece of 10.5-inch diameter sewer pipe with caps on each end. It's sort of a turquoise green PVC pipe of some kind.
You probably got a lot of attention hauling this thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was so funny because every time we came to a stop, I had a friend of mine came up from Las Vegas, and he helped me drive this thing around the clock ahead of a major snowstorm, as you were saying, across country, up through the Rocky Mountains, through Salt Lake City, and across country like that. And we were racing a snowstorm all the way across the country, and it caught up with us by the time we got to Salt Lake. And we just barely got up the west side of the Rockies, climbing up into the mountains, going into Wyoming. I'd left my snow tires and my chains at home because we didn't have any room in the car, because I had to bring all my tools to reassemble this thing once we got on site. But basically what I had to do was I had to pull all these staples to get this thing off of the Masonite, pulled it free, and then I unscrewed and disassembled the 2x2 stretcher frame that would be the underlying structure for this thing once it got to the base. And I rolled, I basically took all these 2x2s, some of which were 16 and, you know, 20 feet long, wrapped them up into a bundle, and then I wrapped the painting around those 2x2s, sort of like the classic Greek faggot. That's what it was called, a bundle of sticks, which symbolized the strength of union. And then single-handedly had to lift this thing up into the tube that was already above my car. It weighed several hundred pounds, so I could only really lift one end of it at a time and then try to lift the other end, and it would bow, and it didn't want to go in. I kind of had to bounce the thing, so the whole thing was sort of wobbling up and down like a giant sine wave made out of canvas and sticks, and, you know, eventually fed this thing into this giant tube, got it all the way in, and then ran home, took a shower, jumped in the car, and headed for Reno, Nevada, where I met up with my buddy. And the funniest part of the whole thing was when people would stop at gas stations and they'd say, you've got some deep sea fishing rigs in there, right? You're going deep sea fishing. You've got your rod and reels in there, right? I had one guy say, my buddy and I, we've been trying to guess what you have in your giant tube there, and we figure it's a full scale drawing, set of drawings for a house, right? Like giant blueprints or something. Right?
Mark McCandlish is our guest, and Mark, in the second half hour here, I want you to tell us about your cryptidults. In the middle of the night, I think people will enjoy what you have to say. And we'll talk about Area 51 too. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away.